to the for the medical treatment. They take to me the hospital with guards and with the handcuffs. But in front of public, they lock me with the handcuff to take to the hospital. It's a anyone see me, they think oh, this guy have done something. But I on that moment, tears fall from my eyes without my permission. But I after that I denied to go to our hospital to get treatment with the handcuff.
Tanush, what is your message to Australians? What is your message to the world? How can people help?
This is my message. Every innocent human has the rights to be free and enjoy their life. No one should have their life put hold indefinite detention for no reason. My friends have been in indefinite detention for no reason. They have to be free into the community. It's going to be must end. But this is the way people need to push the MP or send the letter and make the signatures and push the government to release my friends. For they have been in long-term in detention for no reason.
Well, Tanush, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate you coming on and sharing your experiences. And thank you so much. I'm very grateful.
Thank you so much, brother. Yeah, I appreciate that.
Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Australia has been heavily criticized, both at home and abroad, because of how it treats refugees and asylum seekers. In 2014, the Tony Abbott-led government launched a campaign aimed at deterring refugees from coming to Australia. Its slogan read, "No way, they will not make Australia home." As the poster says, people who travel to Australia by boat without a visa will not end up in Australia. They will be sent for processing in Nauru or Papua New Guinea. Australia's policy is that anyone who comes by boat will be sent to these offshore detention centers. If you enter Australia without a visa, you'll be detained for an indefinite period of time. Australia basically operates offshore detention centers in these countries, such as the infamous migrant detention center in Nauru, a camp that has been compared to Guantanamo Bay. I mean, just look at the map. Look how far away it is from Australia. It's over 4,000 kilometers. It's literally in the middle of nowhere in the Pacific Ocean. And Australia basically wants to send these people off to someplace else and shirk responsibility. So instead of helping refugees and asylum seekers who are fleeing, it punishes them by sending them to a remote island in the middle of the ocean. How is this any different from a penal colony? And now, while the number of detainees has fluctuated and diminished since 2014, and some people have been resettled in Australia or the US, there are still over 100 asylum seekers on Nauru. People who've worked at the migrant detention center in Nauru have described it as a prison. A school teacher said that there are guards at all times everywhere, and that children aren't referred to by their names, but with numbers. Each child has to identify themselves with three digits and three letters. The staff who work there work on rotation. They're told that they shouldn't stay there for more than 3 weeks at a time because it's bad for their mental health. They have to leave the island and take breaks. Well, hold on a second. If it's bad for the staff to stay on Nauru for 3 weeks, for more than 3 weeks, how is it okay for the refugees to stay there for years and years? What does it do to their psychological well-being? What does it do to their mental health? The Australian government said that it wanted to crack down on people smugglers, people who take money in order to smuggle refugees and asylum seekers, bring them to Australia, so it could stop them from making money and exploiting people who are seeking asylum. However, an investigation revealed that the Australian government was paying these smugglers to not bring migrants and refugees and asylum seekers to Australia. So clearly the Australian government doesn't mind the smugglers making money when it's paying them off. Now, it's important, of course, to talk about Australia's obligation to help refugees under international law, within the framework of international law. Australia is a signatory to the 1951 Convention relating to the status of refugees, meaning Australia is responsible for those who seek refuge or protection from its government. However, on numerous occasions, the United Nations has found Australia to be severely lacking in providing for those who seek its help. A report by the UNHCR on Australia's practice of forcibly transferring refugees to Nauru or Papua New Guinea says that, quote, the majority of asylum seekers transferred from Papua New Guinea and Nauru to Australia have still not had their claims for international protection determined after more than 4 years. François Crépeau, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Human Rights of Migrants, decried the conditions on Nauru as, quote, cruel, inhumane, and degrading. The Torture Convention prohibits subjecting people to cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment. In 2015, the UN found that Australia was in violation of this, quote, by leaving people locked up indefinitely in appalling conditions on a remote island, Australia is failing to meet this basic standard. Then Australian PM Tony Abbott responded to the report by saying that he thought Australians are, quote, sick of being lectured to by the United Nations. Now, another myth that is commonly perpetuated is the notion that refugees must claim asylum in the first safe country that they reach. This is completely, absolutely untrue. It's false. That's not a law. That's not a requirement under international law. The Refugee Convention says absolutely nothing about this. And not to mention that many of the countries that refugees pass through to get to Australia are not even signatories of the Refugee Convention, or they simply lack the infrastructure to resettle refugees. Now, when it comes to these offshore detention centers, like in Nauru, it actually costs more money to send refugees to Nauru or Papua New Guinea than to rehome them in Australia. The UNHCR report reads that Australia's National Audit Office confirms that holding refugees and asylum seekers in offshore processing facilities costs approximately 15 times more than allowing them to live in community detention in Australia. An article from The Guardian, published on January 23rd, 2022, says that the Nauru offshore regime will cost Australian taxpayers, quote, nearly $220 million over the next 6 months. $220 million just to hold 107 people. The company that oversees the camp is Construct International. It's received $1.8 billion in the last 5 years alone. The article continues, quote, it currently costs Australian taxpayers more than $4 million a year to hold one person within the Nauru offshore regime. That means a little over $11,000 per person per day. When the Australians talk about their borders and enforcing these strict rules, did they just happen to forget that Australia is a colonial project of the British Empire? When the Australians say, no way, the refugees will not make Australia home, well, what about themselves? All these Europeans and Brits who came to colonize Australia and make it home. Do Australia's natives, the Aborigines, do they get a say in who they want to take in on their land, or is it just the white British and European colonizers who get a say? What a lovely double standard, isn't it? You know, they say they don't want refugees. Well, who's creating these refugees? Didn't Australia invade Afghanistan? Isn't Australia involved in American military operations which destabilize these countries? Doesn't Australia accommodate U.S. imperialism by hosting American bases like the one at Pine Gap? And now this new alliance with AUKUS? The Australians invade Afghanistan, violate Afghanistan's sovereignty, kill Afghans, destroy their homes, occupy their land for 20 years, and then have the gall to say, oh no, you can't come to our place. This is what's so disgusting about this rhetoric, not just from the Australians, but from the Americans, the British, and other Europeans. They complain about refugees on their shores, and they complain about Muslims and Arabs and Afghans invading them, but they don't mind invading Afghanistan, invading Iraq, invading Syria, bombing Somalia. Where do they think these refugees come from? They think people risk drowning in the Mediterranean or off the coast of Australia for fun? If NATO hadn't destroyed Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and all these countries, there wouldn't be a refugee crisis. If the British and the other European colonial powers hadn't invaded, enslaved, and plundered Africa, Latin America, Southeast Asia, and the Middle East for centuries and centuries, you wouldn't have such an imbalance in wealth and development? Why do you think we have developed countries and developing countries? How did we get to a situation where there's such an imbalance between the two? It's precisely because the European colonial powers stole resources and plundered the rest of the planet and enriched themselves. These Western countries invade, kill, steal from others, and then complain about refugees showing up from the countries they destroyed to enjoy some of the wealth that was taken from them. It is such a sickening, vile hypocrisy. It absolutely beggars belief that people cannot see this injustice. People will one day look back on how the West created these refugees and how it treated them, and future generations will find it revolting. Now, Djokovic, he's an international tennis star. He has fame. He has media attention. And he was able to get out after just a few days. But the refugees who are still locked up in the same park hotel as Djokovic was in, they're not as lucky. They need help. And they need people to raise awareness on their behalf. And so do those who are still locked up in these offshore detention centers. They need people to fight for them. They're not criminals. They shouldn't be in detention indefinitely for the crime of seeking asylum, for the crime of trying to find a better life, for the crime of fleeing imperialism, war, and unimaginable horrors. It is their right under international law to seek asylum, and we must never forget that. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of RIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
These days are also the days of the revolution, the Islamic revolution, an event that has been foretold by the Ahlul Bayt, Salamullah alayhim ajma'in, an event that we have been told is near the coming of the Imam of our time, connected to the coming of the Imam of our time, the first stage of the revolution of the Imam of our time, an event that has changed the world and is changing the world, an event that has started the fitan similar to the time of Ali ibn Abi Talib, Amir al-Mu'mineen, salawatullah wa salamuhu alayhi, Amir al-Mu'mineen, when he was asked, begged, to lead the community of believers, the nation of the Prophet, as the ruler. He was there for 25 years. In those 25 years, he didn't say, لَتُغَرْبَلَنَّ غَرْبَلَهُ وَلَتُبَلْبَلَنَّ بَلْبَلَهُ. He didn't say that then. He didn't say, in the first 5 years or so, or whatever number of years, لَتُغَرْبَلَنَّ غَرْبَلَهُ, which means you will be tested, you will be put through a sieve, some of you, and separated. That's the distinction. You know, a sieve, they used to put flour through, or whatever small grains, and the finer ones would go through, and the larger ones would remain. Or sometimes it was used to find gold. The ones that are not gold, those smaller pieces or pieces of soil, gradually they break down and they go through it. What remains are those pieces, those gems. They remain. لَتُغَرْبَلَنَّ غَرْبَلَهُ. When did Ali ibn Abi Talib say this? He said it when he started his government after 25 years. After all these centuries, again the government of the Ahlul Bayt, salamullah alayhim ajma'in, according to their own words, in so many different ways, started, and again the same words of Ali ibn Abi Talib are true. لَتُغَرْبَلَنَّ غَرْبَلَهُ وَلَتُبَلْبَلَنَّ بَلْبَلَهُ. All of you, all of us, are going through these fitan. They started with that. The enemies of Islam pushing people in one direction, the representative of the Imam pushing people in a different direction, and then munafiqeen helping the kuffar, And then some believers helping the na'ib of the imam, the representative of the imam. And all these voices, therefore, are being heard. And some get confused and are not able to make progress with the movement. Others are on the forefronts. They are on the front lines. They are the forerunners of the movement of the imam. These are the times that we are in, and I hope all of us take this opportunity to go and find material, to see what happened, and see for ourselves the signs of divinity. What we just said in regards to the coaching of Fatima al-Zahra, salamullah alayha, and the Ahlul Bayt, salamullah alayhim ajma'in, is clearly seen in Imam Khomeini. Clearly, on a level that is beyond everything and anything else we have seen or experienced prior to that. The coaching that has happened prior to that, at best, the person who's been coached has been able to receive that on a level of personal purification, personal ascension. What Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi, received it on the level and scale of was not only on that level, but he was coached to the level that his decisions about when to stand, when to speak, when to tell people I'm coming to Iran, when to tell people the military officers and soldiers to leave their positions, to join the revolution, when to tell the people to be patient, when to tell people to come out on the streets, when to tell people not to come out on the streets, when to say that we're going to establish a government, when to insist I'm going to come back to Iran. None of these decisions could have been so accurately taken one after the other, leading to the establishment of the Islamic Republic, and then afterwards everything that happened. Putting in the first government based on the recommendations of certain people, giving them that position was divinely guided. Taking that away from them, divinely guided. Putting in even Bani Sa'd, allowing him divine guidance. Coaching of Fatima al-Zahra, salamullah alayha, the a'imma of the ma'asumin, because they are nurun wahid from the perspective of them delivering it to us. They're all the same. We have been given 14 names to refer to ask, to beg, to plead to, each of them for a reason we have been given, but all of them are means and connections to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is the one who guides. They have nothing of themselves. It's all from Allah, and Allah is the one who guides. If he guides through Fatima al-Zahra, it's him. If he guides through Imam al-Husayn, it's him. If he's guiding through Ali ibn Abi Talib, it's him. It's Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala who guides. And he chooses through whom and which of these lights he presents that guidance to whomever he wishes. Clearly, divine guidance in every one of those. We are in need of that type of coaching for ourselves. And the only way, if me as a person, as just one individual, in order to be able to move in the right direction, and to reach my full potential, which is falah, قَدْ أَفْلَحَ الْمُؤْمِنُونَ, prosperity in this world and the hereafter, on all different levels. If I need the coaching of the Ahlul Bayt, if I need the coaching of Fatima al-Zahra, which every single one of us does, then on a social political level, we are definitely in need of that. What are the solutions in governing our societies? One of the groups that worked against the Shah was willing to sacrifice their lives. They did. They had, apparently, from a material perspective, they were martyrs. They were activists against the Shah. They felt that the condition is so bad that they need to take arms against the Shah. But their ideology was a communist, Marxist, socialist ideology. It wasn't an Islamic ideology. They changed names. The last name they had was Fadaiyan Khalq, Cherikhaya Fadaiya Khalq. They considered themselves guerrillas, guerrilla warfare, people with that type of warfare and those types of abilities, working against tyranny, for establishing justice for the masses, for the oppressed people. That was their ideology. They fought against the revolution. Not only that, it was interesting what I learned today, because I already knew that. What I learned today was that they were armed by a Palestinian group, a Palestinian organization that also had socialist ideologies. Now, in Palestine, that movement never reached a point where they liberated Palestine. Of course, that will happen by the hands of the believers, of course. But I want to use this as an example. But the Islamic Republic, at the time, Iran, the Shah's Iran, the monarchy, that was liberated. One of the groups working hard against the Shah is this organization. What happened to this organization, to these people, to these activists who chanted slogans, some of the best slogans against the Shah? They shed blood for removing the Shah. What happened after the revolution succeeded? They became a splinter group that started killing. The problems of trying to take apart the Islamic Republic now after the revolution, calling for independence for the Kurds, calling for independence for the Azeris or the Turks, calling for independence for the Turkmen, particularly in Kurdistan and also in Gumbad-e-Kavus, they call it, a city northeast of Iran, close to the border of Turkmenistan. People there share ethnically, or their ethnicity, they share with people north of the border, at least some, they're Turkmens. Problems, armed movements started against the revolution by this group in Gumbad-e-Kavus and in Kurdistan. The arms, the weaponry that was brought in from people who are fighting Israel. Is fighting Israel good or not? Of course it's great. But what's their ideology? Those, that particular group? Socialists, communists, Marxists. The basis, the core of their belief is based on the teachings of Karl Marx. They fight. Their chants are against tyranny, against this, against that, all of that. What happens when they come to power? The whole communist movement, go back and read that. The socialist movement. They created a revolution in Russia, and based on that, they created the USSR. What were their chants? What were their slogans? They said, we're against tyranny. We're against capitalism. The evil of capitalism. What are the evils of capitalism? Oppression of the masses. What did the USSR do during their times? The type of physical oppression, and in many ways intellectual oppression, that happened within the borders of the USSR are crazier than a lot of the other stuff that we've seen from others. Well, back to the example, this group working against the Shah, they were working against the Shah. The followers of Imam Khomeini, the followers of the Ahlul Bayt, also working against the Shah. The revolution succeeded, the Shah is gone. They should be celebrating, rejoicing along with everyone else. Like, no, the revolution is not over. We need to be in power. And how we're going to do that? The same tactics against the Shah, armed rebellion against the Shah, now armed rebellion against the revolution. We need coaching. We need to receive that guidance from the Ahlul Bayt, salamullah alayhim ajma'in.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen Ghafur Shakurun Wadud Qayyum وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صل عليه.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, dear brothers and sisters, salamu alaikum. So welcome to this episode of Lantern. Now we'll listen to today's story. The title of the story is The Beggar King. Let's start. Once a country was ruled by a king who had no son to succeed to the throne. Since the king was getting old, he wanted to select a suitable heir to rule the country. The king sent out notices throughout his country. The notices invited every qualified young man in the country for an interview with the king. The only qualification for the candidate was that they should have immense love for their fellow human beings. Every young man across the country was very excited at the possibilities of being the ruler of the country. A poor young man from a remote village also read the notice and started to prepare for an interview with the king. The man was a kind, hard-working lad, but he was very poor due to various circumstances. The man had no good clothes to be presentable in the sight of the king, so the young man worked really hard and saved some money to buy him proper clothes and supplies to support him for a long journey to the palace. After he got his supplies and a proper attire for the interview, the young man set out on his quest. He traveled many days and hard and had almost completed the journey when he came upon a poor beggar by the side of the road. The poor beggar sat trembling in the cold, covered only in tattered rags. The beggar extended his arms and pleaded for help. His weak voice croaked, "I'm hungry and cold. Please help me, sir." The young man was so moved by the pathetic condition of the beggar that he immediately stripped his new attire and offered it to him. He also provided him with his very limited food he had carried for the journey. The beggar thanked the man immensely. Since the man had given up his good clothes to the beggar, he was a bit hesitant to go for the interview.
He, however, gathered enough courage to enter the palace in his old dirty clothes. Upon his arrival at the palace, the king's attendants showed him the way to the great hall. The young man bowed low as the king entered the room. When he raised his eyes, he gasped in astonishment as he noticed that the king looked very similar to the beggar he met on the way. Yeah, the king saw the shock in the man's eye and said, "Yes, I was the beggar you met on your way." "But why did you dress up like a beggar? You are the king." "Well then, why did you do this to me?" the young man stammered after gaining some composure. "Because I had to be sure that you had a good heart and you genuinely love your fellow human beings," said the king. "I knew that if I came to you as king, you would have done anything to impress me, but that way I would never have known what is truly in your heart. Beggar had nothing to offer you. The generosity and love to the one in need without expecting anything in return is the sign of a great heart. You have proved that you are the right person to be my successor," promised the king. "Kindness is more important than wisdom, and the recognition of this is the beginning of wisdom."
Dr. Fakhr Rohani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In this episode, we are going to talk about the necessity of helping the poor. According to Quranic indications and Quranic injunctions, people are not expected, people are instructed to be patient with losing something and not feeling proud for having some gains, because all of these losings and gainings are transitory. At the same time, we find that the condition of receiving some gains in this transitory worldly life is just a test for the rich. For example, imagine someone has, for example, 6 houses in a city. Well, he doesn't need more than one house to live in. He can help other people, the poor, with letting other people take shelter in other houses of his. Or, for example, when someone has a car and is driving his car from one place to another, and on the roadside he notices some people waiting for a car to take them some way. It's a kind of being cooperative to other people to take one or two of those people who are standing by the roadside, to help them get closer to their destination. At the same time, we find that people shouldn't feel that if they've been provided with some wealth, they would regard it as a special favor from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to them. Rather, all of these gainings and losings should be regarded as tests from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for the rich. And also for the poor. All people are constantly being put on test by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So moment by moment, we have to think about, not losing this opportunity of being alert enough not to go on our own way. Everybody is expected to be considerate of being aware that no moment in our life we are without being tested, whether we are in a good state or, for example, we've been afflicted with, for example, any grief or any kind of, for example, mishap. The Holy Quran says, "Kalla inna al-insana la yatgha an ra'ahu istaghna." Certainly, some people, or people in general, or mankind, feels proud whenever he finds himself not in need of other people, not in need of the help of other people. At the same time, the Holy Quran says, "Wallahu la yuhibbu kulla mukhtalin fakhur." Certainly, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala doesn't like, I mean, the proud people. I mean, people who have a sense of pride. I mean, in taking pride over some of the gainings. I mean, against other people. So we find that, I mean, wise people should think about, should consider that, I mean, all of these, I mean, wealth, money, or job positions, or for example, any permanent state, or I mean, any permanence in one's, for example, in one's own favorable situation, all of them are tests from the side of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for the poor. I mean, for everybody, and especially for the poor. And then, at the same time, we find that everybody is expected, I mean, everybody is expected to pay some alms every day. And, I mean, apparently simple and not considerable little amount of money, when it's collected, after some time, it must be given, I mean, the whole money should be given to the poor in order to help them. Not only, I mean, financial help, but sometimes, for example, helping other people with other things certainly removes mishaps from those people who have developed this good sense of helping the poor. And this is because we are not living alone. We are human beings. We are not hard-hearted. Rather, we are, I mean, men who are expected to, be considerate of the rights of other people and the, I mean, needs of other people. If everybody, I mean, in his workplace, in his community, thinks well about the right of other people, the right of other human beings, that they must need, they must have their needs well fulfilled. In that case, we find that we will, in the long run, come up with a moral community in which almost no aggression and no suppression would be committed. Thank you.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah.
Ala bi dhikrillahi tatma'innul qulub.
Aperture. Welcome back to Aperture. We witnessed the history of Qasr edifice, the story of a museum that has had so many ups and downs dependent to the different utilization of the place. The journey from a luxurious palace which was converted to a dreadful political prison and is now a museum. The story of the Qasr edifice is intertwined with some of the most turbulent and crucial years of Iran's history. And within the confines of its walls, it holds countless memories of suffering and struggle. Don't go away. Here's the rest of the documentary.
After endless sessions of interrogation and trials that could take several months, they would be sent to one of the political prisons, including the Qasr prison.
تمام طول مدتی که زندانی در کمیته بود.
During the time the prison was in the committee, his family would never know of him at all. One could be there for a year or more or less. Whenever their families would go, for example, to Evin Penitentiary, they couldn't find their children. That's why some families knew their children were there.
در صورتی بعضی از خانواده‌ها می‌دونستن زندانیشون اونجا هست.
It was clear that the Shah had given the green light to Savvak brutality. In hindsight, Savvak harassment merely fanned the flames of the revolution. Mr. Davood Yazdani, a former political prisoner, was a soldier during the revolution. He was arrested for his political activities inside the garrison and spent a long time incarcerated in the Ghas prison.
Savvak Yazdani برای مردم ایران توی مملکت ایجاد کرد و
Savvak's harassment and torture accelerated the downfall of the Shah, and the Iranian people became stronger and stronger and continued the struggle to overthrow the decadent regime.
In 1974, student activities intensified and street demonstrations flared up. With draconian power, Savvak set a reign of terror that lasted 2 years. Many were arrested, tortured, or even killed on the slightest charges. This era was one of the darkest chapters in the history of modern Iran.
در سال 55 رژیم شاه تصمیم داشت.
In 1976, the regime had decided to put in prison whoever showed the least opposition, thinking that in this way it could reduce the numbers of its opponents. Therefore, the prisons of the Shah became overcrowded, that is, political prisons. At that time, the Kasra prison and others were overcrowded.
Inside prisons, clerics would shoulder a special burden to teach young prisoners and broaden their horizons.
Prominent religious scholars like Ayatollah Taleghani and others tried to attract other people rather than to reject them. Even a person who had caved in a little to Savvak torture would get ablaze when associated with such great people.
Savvak, long suspicious of clerics' activities in prisons and afraid of their success, began to hold them back.
تا قبل از سال 53 شرایط بسیار مطلوب بود برای زندانی.
Up to the year 1974, the circumstances were desirable for political prisoners because there was no separation between them. For example, Mr. Taleghani and other prominent figures were all in the same prison, with a young man sentenced to a few months for distributing communiques. Such a man would mix with them and get trained by them. The political prison had become the University of the Revolution. But after the year 1974, most of the religious scholars were transferred to Evin Penitentiary, to a place specifically for religious scholars in order to disconnect their relations with other prisons so as to prevent them from growing.
Identifying different political and ideological currents in prisons and sowing discord among prisoners were on the list of Savvak's priorities. The main aim was to pit opposition leaders against one another, tarnish their reputations and drain them of power so they couldn't fight the regime.
Would this Savvak خیلی تبلیغ میکرد و تحریک میکرد افراد رو به
Savvak itself would provoke prisoners to discuss with each other and pit them against each other. So it was probable that a problem would rise between those people, and the winner was Savvak. So to avoid such a thing inside prison, the prisoners tried to keep their unity, saying, we have a common enemy, and in front of this common enemy, we have to be united and must not provide Savvak with excuses.
By arresting political dissidents, Savak aimed to quench the raging flames of the revolution. But since almost all political prisoners were transferred to Tehran, the prisons became a hive of political activity. The prisoners were filled in on the latest gossip, news, or instructions and announcements issued by Ayatollah Khomeini by their families, who would visit them from every corner of the nation.
The best point of this prison had to do with meetings. A long, narrow corridor, a wall about 1 meter in height, with rails and nettings, and a distance of 1 meter, with offices in between.
When they came here, they would stand behind bars, prisoners on this side. Imagine such a large number of visitors who wanted to talk to prisoners all at the same time in 10 minutes. In 10 minutes, all of them wanted to talk and tell their things. How was it possible for them to do so in 10 minutes? That's while some prisoners and families had to exchange political information from inside and outside the prison.
Mr. Mansouri believes political prisoners have always been well informed about the country's affairs.
After all, political prisoners would try regularly to be up to date and have the best analysis of the issues. It may be interesting to know that we in prison knew much more about the country's issues than those who were outside prison. The reason was that, besides studying and discussing, those families who came to see their children would give them information from all over the country, and this information would come into prison.
Drunk with absolute power, the Shah of Iran gave Savak more leeway to oppress any opposition. No matter how hard political parties struggled, the prospect looked grim. From 1975, Savak stopped releasing political prisoners, even after serving their sentences.
At that time, freedom had no meaning for the political prisoner, even for a person who had finished his term in prison. There are many examples of this case who had finished their terms in prison in 1977, but they were not released from prison.
One week before their release, they would be transferred to Evin Penitentiary, and on their release days, they were forced to sign their detention papers. After serving their time, their families were waiting for them on their release days. They would be counting the days for their release. But not only were they not released on the day, but also they were given a detention paper to sign and held in Evin Penitentiary. What's the significance of Evin? In Evin, there was no visit. The families lost touch with the prisoners again.
In those days, the Shah was the cruelest dictator in the Middle East, and reports on human rights in Iran were disappointing. But since the US didn't put pressure on its Iranian ally, the Shah never admitted the deplorable conditions in his country.
You're saying you do what every country does.
Sure.
If torture is necessary, you torture.
Not the torture in the old sense of torturing people, twisting their arms and doing this and that. But there are intelligent ways of questioning now.
Well, they talk about psychological and physical torture.
Physical, I don't believe.
I talked...
Not anymore. Maybe in the old days, maybe.
I talked just today to a man whom I believe who told about torture.
He was tortured?
Yes.
And you believe that he was tortured?
Yes.
How many years ago?
Within, I want to be very careful, not yesterday.
Ah, well, maybe. I don't know.
The word has gone out to stop it.
To stop what?
Torture.
But a long time ago, yes.
Until 1976, the Shah was a despot, a ruthless man with everything at his disposal. above all the country's wealth. That year, the Republicans in the US stepped down from power. The Shah had spent the country's petrodollars on his favorite candidate, Gerald Ford. But in the end, the young Jimmy Carter, with his slogan of human rights, was sworn in as the new president of the United States.
The human rights must be absolute, but let no one confuse our idealism with weakness. Because we are free, we can never be indifferent to the fate of freedom elsewhere.
During the U.S. presidential elections, in order to earn a domestic and international reputation, the Democratic nominee announced his decision over abiding by human rights because his predecessors didn't do that at all. They were Republican, abrasive, belligerent, and suppressive. When they came to power, they asked all the dictators who were U.S. pawns to open political space and improve the image of the U.S.
The Shah of Iran made a U-turn on political freedom and an attempt to win favor with the new U.S. president. As a result, the Savak's harassment reduced and political activities increased.
It was decided that international organizations like the Red Crescent, Amnesty International, the Human Rights Organization, to visit the country's prisons, the political prisons. The Joint Counter-Sabotage Committee had a torture chamber. They quickly put some shelves in the torture chamber and converted it into a library. They put the books they had taken from us there to tell the international organizations that they had a library in the prison.
With this democratic gesture, the Shah aimed to ameliorate the situation and persuade the White House to sell him arms. Both Carter and the Shah rested assured that with the Savak and the most powerful army in the region, an open political space would never put the regime in danger.
The U.S. Senate had asked the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Cyrus Vance, "Mr. Vance, if political freedom in Iran leads to the downfall of the Shah, you will be held responsible." Vance said that they would abide by human rights as far as U.S. national interests were safe.
In the end, opening a political space, rather than diffusing the situation, helped the opponents hold demonstrations, deliver speeches, and attack Savak for its crimes on an unprecedented scale.
Anyway, as they faced the events in 1977 and 1978, they found out that they couldn't do anything because they had done anything possible without being successful. They agreed to have an open political space since the U.S. had asked them. They were to hold a free election and form a national government, but in reality, from early 1979, they lost control and could do nothing, although Jimmy Carter called the Shah several times, allowing him to do anything to control the situation, and assured the Shah of his support. In other words, Carter said what Cyrus Vance had said before. The U.S. didn't want the Shah to fall, but to improve the situation a little bit.
These changes improved the situation for political prisoners, and old lags on small charges were released.
به خاطر اینکه اون ساواک دیگه اون پشتیبانیشو از دست داده بود.
Since SAVAK had lost its support, it was forced to release many prisoners, those who had finished their terms and those who were in prison for very simple unarmed activities.
در زندان بودن گروه گروه شروع کرد آزاد کردن.
On October the 24th, 1978, 1,126 political prisoners were released. Among them was Safar Qahramani, one who had been in different prisons for about 30 years. By releasing these prisoners, most of them on minor charges like reading forbidden books, the regime wanted to control public indignation. The newly released prisoners went to Beheshte Zahra Cemetery to pay homage to those who lost their lives fighting for freedom. They said they owed their freedom to public support, not to the false benevolence of the regime. In January 1979, the Shah left Iran under the pretext of receiving medical treatment. Weeks later, Imam Khomeini returned to Iran after 15 years of exile. His arrival gave the nation a new lease of life. Within a short space of time, the people took control of all military and strategic centers, including the Qasr prison, and released all political prisoners. A number of army top brass and SAVAK agents were arrested and put in the prison for a while. The first trials to investigate their crimes were held in the mosque of this prison. After the 1979 revolution, the Qasr prison was converted into an ordinary prison. But since it was located inside the residential district, in 2001 it was closed down forever. The municipality of Tehran then reconstructed the building and turned it into a museum. A museum that embodies the 200-year history of modern Iran.
During the time I was in the political department of the Garda Museum, I saw the youth we talked to change their opinions completely at the end of their visit. They couldn't believe that in Iran, under the Shah, such things existed. The society must be informed about it. The world must be informed about it.
For me, these things must be etched on the walls of the Qasr prison. Here is the mirror reflecting the downfall of cruelty and corruption.
The Qasr Garden Museum in the heart of Tehran, a place that would once send shivers up and down spines, has now become a favorite haunt for people.
Most of the visitors who come here have a critical attitude, but when they're leaving here, they are overwhelmed and express their kindness to us. When it's explained for them, they realize what had happened here and who had to bear what harms and sufferings.
With its many programs and shows, the museum magnetizes a variety of visitors from friends and families to school students and tourists.
In my opinion, the Qasr Garden Museum is a national place, and its programs must be national and distinguished, and even have a look at international programs. I believe that these bricks in this space are alive with the breaths of people. They must come and go if we want this place to be alive. When you enter Qasr Garden Museum, we see a pleasant place. That's due to the breaths of families who come here willingly.
A palace, a prison, and now a museum. A witness to the pain and grief of many people, this edifice has many stories to tell the children of this ancient land.